You know what the subject matter is, and what I propose to do in this lecture is to explain as simply as possible Marx's theory on rent, interest and profit, and to deal with the theory of the falling rate of profit. It's that last part, by the way, of course, which is likely to be most interesting, but you can't get at it without going through the earlier theory. Like Marx's explanation of what determines wages and prices, it all rests on Marx's labour theory of value. And it might be useful if I first give a very broad outline of the production of wealth in capitalist society and the way that wealth is divided up. We start with the fact that nearly all the annual output of goods and services in a capitalist country is by members of the working class. And the first division is into wages and salaries on the one side and surplus value on the other, respectively the incomes of the working class and of different sections of the capitalist class. Now, after that has taken place, so to speak, there is a second division, which is the division of surplus value into rent, interest and profit. And what I'm going to do is to explain Marx's theory on this division into these three parts. One thing you have to bear in mind is that while all workers are exploited in that they give unpaid labour to the capitalist class, to their employer, it's only the workers in the productive process, as Marx called it, farming, mining, manufacture, and transport, etc., who actually create surplus value. But although only part of the workers create surplus value, all of the workers, of course, receive wages and salaries, and that's a point that I'll pick up again later. There are one or two terms that need explaining. Marx showed that the worker in the productive process produces a value greater than the value of his labour power, that is, greater than his wages. In effect, when a worker sells his labour power to the capitalist for a week's wages, he will produce a value equal to his wages in, say, 3 days out of the 5-day week, and in the other 2 days, he will be giving unpaid labour to the capitalist. Marx called this surplus value, and the ratio of surplus value to wages he called the rate of surplus value or the rate of exploitation. If I give an example, just to bring it home, suppose a capitalist invests £100,000, of which £50,000, that's a half, is spent on wages. And suppose that the surplus value created is £30,000, then the rate of exploitation or rate of surplus value is 60%. That is £30,000 over £50,000, the surplus value over the wages. But the rate of profit is different. Here the ratio is £30,000 over £100,000, that is 30%. In other words, as the capitalist reckons his profit, it's related to the whole of the capital that is invested. Now this is the first division, as it were. The working class produce the wealth, or part of the working class produce the wealth. It belongs to the capitalist class. The workers get wages and salaries, and the capitalist class as a whole gets surplus value. Now the second division is into rent, interest and profit. And if I may go into a bit of detail here in order to get certain things clear. If a manufacturer owned the land on which his factory is built and had no need to borrow from money-lending capitalists and did all his own wholesaling and retailing, he would get the whole of surplus value as his profit, except, of course, that he'd have to pay tax on it. If, however, he did not do his own wholesaling and retailing, but sells his commodities to a wholesaler, then what happens is that he sells his commodities to the wholesaler at a price which is going to be lower than the final market price. And it's out of that difference that the merchant running the wholesale side of it gets his due return on capital. So that in that case, the industrial capitalist sells his commodities to the wholesaler at a price below the final market price, and both the manufacturing capitalist and the merchant capitalist will get, or tend to get, what Marx called the average rate of profit on his capital invested. Now, if the industrial capitalist also borrows from a money-lending capitalist, he also has to pay interest out of his surplus value. If he rents land on which his factory is built, he's got to pay rent to the landowner. If, of course, the capitalist does own his own land and does his own wholesaling and retailing, you see he's got to have much more capital invested in it than he would if he merely did looked after the manufacturing side in the factory itself. Now, I want to have a look at the actual division into wages and salaries on the one side and surplus value on the other. We start from the proposition that the capitalists have an interest in increasing the rate of exploitation by extending the working day, driving the workers to the limit of their capacity, eliminating unoccupied time in the working day, and keeping wages down, which the capitalist always does to the as far as he can. He will have a lower wages bill, and he will therefore increase his rate of profit. Now, some people, including Marx and Engels in the early part of the 19th century, took the view that the workers and their very weak trade unions were almost helpless to resist capitalist pressure, and it was only in times of a boom, when unemployment was very low, that the workers could hope to get just a temporary improvement in their conditions. I've mentioned on an earlier occasion Ferdinand LaSalle. Ferdinand LaSalle took the view, different from Marx's, took the view that the workers were so helpless that all the workers would ever get was a bare subsistence wage. Unless they could never rise above that, as the introduction of machinery increased the output of the workers, all the increase in output would go to the capitalist class, and no matter how much the workers produced, the workers would still be living on a bare subsistence wage. But of course, facts have proved this wrong, and Marx showed that it was wrong, and of course it is wrong. But late in life, Marx and Engels changed their own view. In the beginning, they thought that trade unions were so weak they could do hardly anything, except in times of a boom. Later on in life, they saw that the workers, through trade union organisation, could in fact put up some quite effective resistance to capitalist pressure. You will find Engels' view in the 1892 preface to the reprint of his Condition of the Working Class in England in 1844. On page 33, he says of the factory workers that in 1892, and I quote, they were undoubtedly better off than before 1848. And for the workers in the big trade unions, he wrote this: the engineers, the carpenters and joiners, the bricklayers, are each of them a power, to the extent that in the case of the bricklayers and bricklayers' labourers, they can even successfully resist the introduction of machinery. That their condition has remarkably improved since 1848, there can be no doubt. So you see that Marx and Engels did change their view, and they did realise that as the trade unions got stronger and had more experience, that they could put up quite an effective resistance to exploitation. And there is information about the way in which the workers' wages in this country did rise in the second half of the 19th century. That's the half that Engels is talking about, when he said that the organised workers had remarkably improved their position. It's been calculated, it's an estimate, that there was a rise of wages between 1850 and 1914 of about 86%. And this, by the way, is a rise of real wages. There was no inflation then, so that you didn't have to knock away the bulk of it because prices had risen. It sounds quite a lot, of course, 86%, but you'll realise that cumulatively it's somewhere about 1% a year from 1850 up to 1914. The rise was, of course, not continuous. Sometimes real wages were falling or stationary. They always fell in the Depression, and they always rose again when trade recovered and a boom came along. But on the whole, over the half century, the workers did end up better off than they were at the beginning. Now, you will remember, I pointed out in a previous lecture, dealing with productivity, that more or less continuously, there is an increase of the workers' output due to the introduction of more machinery and more sophisticated processes of production. So that it is possible for wages to increase and the amount of surplus value also to increase. See, suppose you have over a long term, an increase of each worker's output averaging about 2% a year, it would theoretically be possible for half of that to go in increased wages, and the other half to go in an increase of surplus value. But remember, I'm talking here about the amount of surplus value, not the rate of surplus value, because that is subject to different conditions. Now, the first of these divisions I want to deal with is the rent of land, which comes out of surplus value, just as interest and profit. They all come out of surplus value. There's no other source from which they can come. If the capitalist doesn't own his land, he has to pay land. He has to pay rent to the man who does own the land. Now, the first point you want to notice about this is that, unfortunately, in the English language, we talk about tenants paying rent for houses. Well, rent for houses has nothing whatever to do with Marx's theory of rent. It is not rent for land. It is the mere purchase of a commodity like buying a pair of shoes. What the worker is doing when the tenant pays what is called rent to the landlord, all he's really doing is buying the commodity accommodation and paying for it, just as he pays for a pair of shoes or food or a suit of clothes or anything else. And if you're interested in this, Engels dealt with it in a pamphlet called The Housing Question, which is worth looking up. But here, all you need to remember is that when you're dealing with the theory of rent, the so-called rent of houses has nothing to do with it. It doesn't come into the picture at all. Now, dealing with the real question, which is the rent of land, you want to notice several things. First thing you want to notice is that land is not a commodity. Land is not produced by labour, and land has no value. Now, a lot of people are puzzled about this. A lot of the critics of Marx, they say, well, surely land must have a value because it's got a price. Well, you'll find in the first volume of Capital, Marx dealt with this thing. And while Marx said that every commodity, that is every product of labour put on the market for sale, while every commodity has a value and has a price, it is not true that everything which has a price has to be a commodity and have a value. And land is one of them. Land is not a commodity. It has no value, though it has a price. Marx gave various examples. I think one of the things he talked about, a little abstract, he said that in the English language you talk about somebody selling his honour. Well, he gets a price for it, but you can't call it a commodity. And in the modern times, if somebody pays a couple of hundred thousand quid for a painting by Rembrandt, that is not a commodity. I mean, it's a unique thing for which it gets a monopoly price. Land has a price because it is a monopoly. The capitalist, if he wants to enter into production, he's got to set up his factory on the land or his office on the land, or both of them together, whether he's in farming or factory production, and the landowner will not let the industrial or commercial capitalist use his land unless they pay for it, pay him a price for it. So the rent is part of the surplus value that the manufacturing capitalist has to hand over, because the landowner will not let him use his land unless he pays the landlord for it. Now, what is it that determines the price of land? If an investor buys land, what he is doing is paying a capital sum in order to get an annual income from rent. And Marx called it the capitalization of the rent. Now, suppose an investor's got £100,000, and suppose that the rate of interest, the going rate of interest at that time, is 10%, then he could, say, lend his £100,000 to the government, buy some government stock, get 10% on it, and get an income of £10,000 a year, one-tenth of £100,000. And he doesn't have to do anything for it. He just lends the money and sits down and receives the 10% interest. Now, if the, as I say, the rate of interest is 10%, that investor would only be willing to pay £100,000 for a piece of land if that land also would give him a rent of £10,000 a year, equal to the amount he could get as interest. And then if he did this, you see, if the man with £100,000 bought some acres of land, of which the rent he was going to receive is £10,000 a year, then he also can sit down, just like the man who lends money to the government, receive his £10,000, and he has nothing to do for it. He's lent his money, and that's what he gets for it. So now you see why the rate of interest affects the price of land. Low interest rates tend to put up the price of land, and high interest rates tend to reduce the price of land. There are other factors that come into it, but this is a factor that you have to deal with. Now, that basically is Marx's theory of rent. The landowner has a monopoly. You can't carry on production without using his land, so he won't let you use his land unless he pays for it. And the amount that you pay for land is influenced by what happens to be the rate of interest at the time that the transaction takes place. Now, Marx also dealt with what he called differential rent. That is the higher rent that is paid for land that is above average fertility, or the higher rent that is paid for land that, owing to its location, is more in demand than some other land. I'm not going into this because it's a quite simple proposition and it hasn't any real relevance to it. But if you want to look it up, there were a couple of articles in the SS in March and April 1975 dealing both with absolute rent and with differential rent. And again, I remind you that rent, like interest and profit, all come out of surplus value. Now, the next part that the industrial capitalist has to hand over is interest. If he's carrying on production in a factory and he finds it necessary to borrow some money from a money-lending capitalist, then, of course, he's got to pay interest on it. And the essential thing you need to bear in mind about Marx's theory of interest is that while there are economic laws which govern market prices of commodities and govern wages and govern surplus value, there is no similar economic law governing interest. You see, when Marx dealt with market prices, he said that market prices fluctuate about what he called the price of production. Well, you can't lay down any similar law for interest. There is no such economic law about which interest rates fluctuate. And as Marx put it, there is no natural rate for interest. He went on to say that interest rates are solely the result of supply and demand. Now, you notice how this differs from commodities. With regard to a commodity, you can get a concept of a commodity selling at its price of production, and then say under market conditions, the actual price will fluctuate above and below the price of production. But you cannot say this about interest, because there is nothing else that governs interest rate except supply and demand. And I quote from Marx, it's in volume 3 of Capital, page 430, "The relation between the supply of loanable capital on the one side and the demand for it on the other side decide at any time the market rate of interest." In other words, at the particular time that the capitalist wants to borrow money, the interest he'll have to pay for it will depend solely on how many capitalists with money that they want to lend are coming forward in relation to the demand for it. And both the supply of money, so to speak, and the demand for it fluctuate enormously. Marx thought, at the time he wrote, that there was a tendency for interest rates over the long period to fall. And his reason was this. He said after a lot of capitalists had made a lot of money in manufacture, they wanted to live like gentlemen. They retired from manufacture. They cashed all their assets, got it in a money form, and then they simply lived on the interest. So as Marx said, you've got more capitalists becoming money-lending capitalists, so the supply of interest in relation to the demand increased, so there was a tendency for interest rates to fall. Now, this did go on approximately to the end of the 19th century, and it then appeared to reverse. Interest rates began to rise again. And by the way, I'm talking about the long-term trend of interest rates, not the violent fluctuations, which are really the most important aspect. And just as in Marx's time, there were more capitalists pulling out of business and becoming passive receivers of rent, the tendency in our own time has been different, largely because of the inflation, and also because in the English taxation system, the rate of tax is higher on what they call unearned income than it is on earned income. So there's been a pressure for capitalists who would formerly have been passive receivers of interest to get back into business, and partly because of inflation, which is all the time eroding the value of the interest they receive, and partly because they pay less tax if they're nominally actively engaged in business than if they are passive receivers of interest. But of course the outstanding feature of interest rates is the violent way they fluctuate. As Marx said, they're solely governed by supply and demand at that particular time. And Marx noted as a fact that generally interest rates rise moderately in the period of capitalist expansion leading up to a boom. During the boom, they usually fall. And then when a crisis comes along, interest rates leap up, because at a time of crisis, there are a lot of capitalists having debts to meet and being unable to sell their commodities at a profit are in desperate need of money, and they're therefore prepared to pay almost any rate that's asked for in order to get their hands on some cash. So it's at a time of crisis that you get a violent rise in interest rates. But even so, there is no real pattern about it. Generally speaking, of course, the rate of interest has to be lower than the rate of profit. I mean, obviously the capitalist who's actually in the manufacturing business doesn't expect to pay a rate of interest on money equal to the rate he's getting as his profit. If he did, of course, he would say, well, there's no real advantage in doing it. But you'll realise that in a time of crisis, he has no choice. If the choice is going out of business next week, he'll go into the market and try to borrow money at any possible rate that he can possibly get people to lend him money at. And sometimes, therefore, the capitalist will be paying a rate of interest bigger than the rate of profit. In other words, he'll be left with nothing at all, or even running for a time at a loss. He can't do it indefinitely, but if he's trying to keep his head above water, he'll be prepared to pay any rate of interest that the market demands at the moment. A second thing you have to notice about this is Marx was writing at a time when there was no inflation, and what he said about that applied. Now you come to inflation. When you get inflation, interest rates rise, quite apart from these other violent fluctuations. Interest rise so that you've now got what's the highest rate ever in this country, a bank rate of 17%. And it rises because of inflation itself, quite apart from the demand and supply of money. And it rises for the quite obvious reason that if you have an inflation rate of, say, 20%, and you lend money at anything less than 20%, you're worse off at the end of the year than you were at the beginning. In other words, you've lost, through the depreciation of the money you lend, more than you're going to get on the interest. So when there's inflation, inevitably there is a reluctance on the part of lenders to lend, although sometimes they may have to. So inevitably, during inflation, interest rates rise. In the Great German Inflation of 1923, people were borrowing money at 1,000% a week. Something like this. I mean, there's simply no limit to it. They were just trying to keep their heads above water. But here you get a remarkable thing. There's abundant evidence that all through the 19th century and in the 20th century, that when you have too much money, you have inflation and interest rates go up. But in spite of that, there are people, Marx dealt with them in his lifetime, he dealt with it in the Critique of Political Economy, there are people who held the view, which superficially looks attractive. They say, well, obviously if there's more money about, interest rates must fall. Proudhon held this view, and Marx showed that Proudhon where he was wrong, and experience shows that it is wrong. But in this century, there was an economist, Silvio Gazzelle, who repeated this theory. He said, look, obviously the more money about, the lower the interest rates must be, because there's more money being available to be borrowed. And Gazzelle elaborated this theory. He even produced a way in which it could be worked. He said that what the government should do, instead of having a pound note, which is always worth a pound, they should have a pound note which after a month falls to 90 pence, and then after 2 months to 80 pence, and so on. And it would be done by the government. So everybody who got money would be hurrying to sell it, you see, before it had to be discounted. And Gazzelle said, look, if you did this, you'd have permanent boom. Now, the man who fell for this was John Maynard Keynes. Keynes made the remark that Gazzelle had more to offer the modern world than Karl Marx. And believe it or not, at the Radcliffe Committee on the Monetary Committee set up by the government in 1958, Sir Roy Harrod and others actually gave evidence to the Radcliffe Committee repeating this nonsense of Gazzelle and Keynes, that the more money you print, the lower will interest rates be. And this was written up in the Lloyd's Bank review in October 1976, where somebody pointed this out about Sir Roy Harrod and the Radcliffe Committee, and also repeated a story. He gave the names of the people of a man in charge of economic studies at one of the universities, had to tell the people who sent examination papers that they were at the poll. They were putting into examination papers questions based on Gazelle and asking the students to come along and say, you know, the more money about, the lower interest rates will be. And as the Lloyds Bank Review pointed out, at the very moment they were saying this, interest rates were rising, you know, every month or so. Of course, more money was being put about. But the fact remains, as I say, that you still get people who believe this. Now I come to the question of the actual division of surplus value into rent, interest and profit. It would be very interesting to know how, in fact, it is divided up, you know, how much goes to each. But I don't know of any figures which would tell us this. Possibly somebody has tried to work it out. But you're up against this problem. Company reports will tell you how much interest they pay, but they never tell you how much rent they pay. I mean, rent is treated just as an expense of production, I mean, overhead, and they don't tell you. And the government published very elaborate figures, but they also lumped together rent of land and rent of houses, so the figure is a largely meaningless one. They publish a figure called rent, but they lump together land rent, house rent, and the estimated rent element in owner-occupied houses and farms, and houses supplied rent-free. They don't divide it up so that you cannot, in fact, make any useful conclusion from it. We do know, of course, that the rate of interest varies enormously according to whether capitalism is expanding or is in crisis or in a depression. And, of course, it... during an inflation period, it's tending to go up all the time. In February 1978 and February 1980, the Financial Times summarised the results of some 150 or so industrial companies reporting in the previous month. Those published in January 1978 paid away 14.3% of their total pre-tax profits on interest. That's 14.3%. When you come to 1980, much the same lot of companies paid away 21.7% of their profit in interest. In other words, an increase of 50%, due partly to the fact that interest rates had been rising generally owing to inflation, and partly, I suspect, that capitalists were doing worse in February 1980 than they were in 1978, and therefore there were more capitalists under pressure to try to borrow money. I now come to the actual division of the annual national income as between wages and salaries on the one side and profits on the other. There are government figures for this. In 1978, the total of wages and salaries of some 23 million workers in this country was £84,000. Incidentally, for this purpose, the government statisticians include directors as their fees or their salaries. Now, it would be logical to say that a director is paid on a salary, it comes into wages and salaries, but they also, I think, just to save complication, they include also directors who are paid by fees, as if it is a salary. Not that it makes a great deal of difference to the total figure. Anyway, that total figure is 84,000 million. The second division is one in the middle, between the workers and the capitalists. There are some 2 million people that the government classify as self-employed. That's professional people, partners and people trading on their own, and also farmers. They got in 1938 13,000 million. Now, the total of profits of companies and the profits of nationalised industries in 1978 were 22,000 million. All of these figures, by the way, are before deduction of tax. Now, a question immediately arises, various people have raised it from time to time, why is it that profits appear to be so small in relation to the total wages and salaries? As you will see, only about a fifth, the profits are only about a fifth of wages and salaries. And the people who raise this question say it seems to be in conflict with what Marx wrote in Capital about the rate of exploitation of the working class. Well, there are several reasons which explain this. First thing to note is that when Marx dealt with the rate of exploitation, he wasn't dealing with the whole working class. He was dealing with the workers in the productive process. But there are lots of workers not in the productive process. So whatever the may be true of the workers in the productive process, the fact remains that the workers who are not in production, but are in the circulation process or are in the government service or in the armed forces, they still get wages and salaries. And this is not only something that was partly true when Marx wrote, but it's become very much more true because the number of workers not in the productive process has enormously increased since that time. For example, in 1881, the number of workers employed in the civil service and local government was 146,000. Now, it is 1,638,000. It's more than 10 times as much. In other words, it's increased ever so much more than the increase in population. And you see, by the way, the same trend in some separate figures published by the Government Statistical Office for manufacturing industry. Unfortunately, they've now stopped publishing them. But between 1948 and 1967, they published every year the total profits of manufacturing industry as a whole, their total wages bill, and their total salaries bill. And the interesting thing is that between 1948 and 1967, while the number of manual workers in factories decreased by 8%, in other words, you think of the manual workers as being mainly the productive workers, the number of salaried staff in factories increased by 70%. And incidentally, it led to the result of an almost continuous fall in the profits of manufacturing companies. But anyway, this reflects something that has happened in capitalism since Marx's day. Another factor to be borne in mind is that in the post-war years in this country, with low unemployment until comparatively recently, workers' wages and salaries were gaining on profits in the years, say, from 1945 to 55 and 60. It should also be remembered that since 1950, British capitalism has been less and less competitive as against the Germans and the Japanese, who by that time had recovered from the war and had all their factories re-equipped with American money and so on, so that British capitalism has been losing ground in the world. And lastly, on this subject, you don't have to assume that what is true of this country is true of other countries. There are lots of countries in the world, I mean the OPEC, the oil-producing countries, for example, where I've not the slightest doubt that the picture is a very, very different one. And that is that profits in those countries represent a very much larger percentage of the total wage and salary bill than they do in this country. Now, that is a division of the national income on the basis of wages and salaries, income of the self-employed, and profits. There is another different division, which somewhat overlaps this, which divides the national income into the according to the size of the individual income, whether he's a worker or a capitalist. And you see there are some workers, obviously, will be getting a larger income than some of the smaller capitalists. And so the classification first into wages and salaries, and then classification into the size of the income, they overlap and give a somewhat different picture. In Marx's lecture, which published as the pamphlet Value, Price and Profit, Marx quoted some figures according to which 1/6 of the population received 2/3 of the national income, 67% of the national income. Or he even said it might even be more extreme than this, that only 1/7 of the population received 2/3 of the national income, which meant that 80% of the population, or even 86% of the population between them, only received 1/3 of the national income. Well, there's obviously been quite a big shift in the direction of raising the percentage obtained by the 80% of the population since the time Marx wrote. According to the Lord Diamond Committee on Income and Wealth, in 1972, 80% of the population, who you remember when Marx wrote only got 1/3 of the national income, In 1972, 80% of the population were getting 57% of the national income.